We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started. Hello, everyone. As usual, stay tuned to the end of the interview where I'll give you some actionable insights that I learned from my guest. These insights are also in the show notes, and all of the show notes are over at theentrepreneurethos.com. As always, thanks for listening. Now, on to my guest for today, Steve Taylor, partner with the franchise consulting company and former franchise owner. Steve grew up in Fresno and started his career in the Navy. After that, he worked in Silicon Valley, but always felt like a square peg in a round hole. He bought a flooring franchise and owned that business until recently when he sold it and joined the franchise consulting company. The firm represents over 300 companies to help develop and promote their franchises and connect them with franchisees. Steve also meets with franchisees to help them and advise on setting up their own franchises. The concept of franchising is as old as the first private corporation, East India Company, which was basically a franchise of the king. Franchises come in a variety of models. When people usually think fast food restaurants as the most common type of franchise, Steve says that 70% of franchises are actually not restaurants. The major benefit of franchise is that you reduce the risk involved. You are buying the rights to set up a business using a particular brand and process that already is proven to work. The classic model of a fast food restaurant retains their flag stores to test out new products, but most of their business is generated through franchises, right? Franchisees also benefit from the help and support from not only the company, but other franchisees as well. Now, let's get better together. Steve Taylor, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jari. It's good to be here.
Well, I appreciate you being here. You are just kind of over the east, over in Pleasanton. I'm here in San Francisco. It's almost a San Francisco summer. It's about to get really cold. And it's about to get really hot where you are, because I can always tell. For those of you that don't know about San Francisco, if you ever come visit here in the summer, bring a sweat, because it's horrible. But when it's horrible cold here, where Steve is, it is ridiculously hot California-wise, right?
So I would put a little bit different.
Okay.
Where I live, I'm surrounded by vineyards and the odd brewery, and it's warm. We have a pool and we use it, and we've got an outdoor barbecue, and we can stay outside till 11 o'clock at night. I've got an outdoor TV. And whereas Jari would be literally freezing his ears off, I'm really enjoying a pleasant evening in the summer. So that's how I would describe it.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's always we always like to fight about that, the city folk and the Eastern folk, but
yeah,
country folk, quote unquote. Right. So, So you're a partner over at the franchise consulting company, which I find really fascinating because it has to do with franchises, not only, you know, helping people set them up for themselves, but also helping companies set up their own franchising. And, you know, as entrepreneurs, we rarely talk about kind of the businesses that are the, I don't know, Americana, bread and butter, blue collar kind of stuff. Usually it's tech, SaaS, blah, blah, blah. But there's definitely a different facet to that as an entrepreneur. So can't wait to dig into all that. But as I always like to say on the first question is always the same. I'm pretty consistent in this. why don't you tell us how you got to do what you're doing today?
Sure. I would be happy to, Jari. So I just a warning, I'm kind of sarcastic and I think I'm funny. So hopefully this isn't overwhelming to your podcast users, but I think it all started in my youth in Fresno, California. I grew up in Fresno. I was the youngest of three sons, and ended up going to the Naval Academy. And my parents, before my oldest brother was born, moved from San Diego up to Fresno. And a couple of years after I left to go to college, they moved back to San Diego. And if you know the geography in California at all, you probably realize why. But anyways, I went to the Naval Academy, served in the Navy, frankly, all over the world, enjoyed that. It was a great great experience for me. And ended up in the Bay Area. I left the Navy, worked in Silicon Valley for a number of years, but always felt like it was kind of a square peg in a round hole type thing. Things just didn't quite make sense to me at times. And some things did, and it was exciting. It was fun. But eventually I started my own business, which turned out to be a franchise, very different, flooring, retail and contracting. And about 3 years ago, I sold it, sold the final piece of it last fall. During that transition period, I came aboard as a partner with Nick Neonakis and the Franchise Consulting Company. And we've been doing a number of different things. And the two primary things we do is, number one, we work and represent about 350 to 400 franchise concepts, promoting those to individual buyers who want to purchase franchises. There we go. I should know that, huh? And then we also work with companies. We have a great soup to nuts solution. Let's say you have a business, maybe you have 2-3 locations, and want to explore a growth strategy using franchising.
Interesting. And just, can you just briefly talk about what a franchise is? I mean, I know some people may understand. I just like to get like the simple explanation because, you know, there's different types of franchising and depending on what you're looking at. And the reason this comes to top of mind is I remember, I think I got a copy of Entrepreneur Magazine the other day. Uh-huh. Literally, it was like the franchise edition. And I'm just looking through it. And it's like, oh, top 200 franchises. And I'm like, I didn't even know there was that many. So yeah, if you could just sort of, just quickly, because.
Sure. Level set. Sure. And, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions. So quickly, what you're doing as a franchisee is you are renting some type of proprietary knowledge, some type of IP, if you will, in exchange, you know, you're paying to rent that. And that could be trademarks, that could be any number of different things. So two things I want to point out. Number one, there is a very long history of franchising. I don't know. I love history. And the East India Company is, when was it for the 15th or no, I'm sorry.
East India, that was like 1600s. Like,
yeah, yeah.
That was the actual, interestingly enough, I know you love history. That was the actual first private company chartered
Like usually they were kings that had all this money, or queens or whatever. They were like the first publicly, they were the first public corporation, which is just fascinating. Like you're like, really? 1600? Something like 1600, 1640. I don't remember, but yeah.
Yeah. So my point is they were a franchise, right? The king gave them a charter to go somewhere and do something in exchange for that. They provided benefit back to the king. So today's franchise isn't that much different than that. And
sans the racism and all the others.
Well, I suppose they're
a little different.
I was going to make a joke about Ku Klux Klan franchising, but I can't in today's environment. I mean, it just wouldn't be.
Good, better part of valor.
Yeah. My, which again, if you know me, it's, that was near miss. But my point being is this has been around a long time. And the deal is the king didn't have the money and the people to expand his brand, right? So he gave up some control. He gave up some upside for a consistent revenue stream. And that is that's what McDonald's does. That's what Burger King does. You know, everyone else does. Or a modern franchise does. The other thing I want to point out is there are a huge amount of models. A lot of people think, oh, well, McDonald's. Well, yeah, McDonald's. But food franchises really are less than 30% of the franchises. There are about 4,000 franchises registered in the U.S., and about 30% of them are restaurants. So that's a big segment. But what that means is there are 70%, again, my knowledge of math, you know, I can just spew out those numbers. 70% of those companies are non-food. And that could be business to business. That could be, it could be bookkeeping. It could be some things you haven't even heard of. And in fact, I would say there are a lot that I had never heard. And I'm seeing new concepts every day that had never occurred to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you bring up that only 30% are restaurants, because that's interesting, because that's what you think of. You think of the McDonald's, the TGI Fridays, I guess. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing I don't always quite understand. There's the corporate company, and then sometimes corporations will have their own store, or then they'll franchise out a store. I mean, Starbucks, I think, does this, or at least they were doing that. Or it always gets muddled because, let's give it McDonald's. That's the best example. So there could be, I think, corporate-owned McDonald's and then franchise-owned McDonald's, or is it just all like?
I don't know McDonald's specifically, but let me give you a typical scenario. Let's say, you've got a couple, taco trucks, and they're really kind of cool and they really work. What I would do in my role as a developer would come alongside you, make sure all the administrative paperwork's in place, make sure you're aligned with different people, different entities, say, maybe finance, maybe operations or a food vendor or whatever. And then we'd blow it out. You would hold on to those. In a lot of cases, you would hold on to those two trucks to use as test kitchens or as use test cases or whatever. But then you would end up with 1,000 food trucks that were franchised around the country, around the world, frankly. That's very typical. I believe McDonald's does that, but they might be so big. Well, I'm sure they have individual test kitchens. But I know I'm thinking of a couple food brands I represent. They maintain their corporate-owned stores so they can roll out things first there before they roll them out to the franchisees.
Yeah, yeah. I think isn't In-N-Out, is that a franchise model? Or
I believe those are all corporate-owned. Okay. Chick-fil-A is their franchises, but it's a very different franchise model. Wonderful people, by the way. But a very different model than we represent. you know, things like Yum Brands is a big.
Right. Right. I was going to say
franchise ownership.
That's like Taco Bell. And
yeah, I think for a long time, they also owned Burger King's or, you know, I don't know. You know, I know the name, but
right. Right.
That's a different galaxy in which I typically.
What's like a non-food brand that's a franchise that people may not know is a franchise? Do you have one offhand?
Something like Fast Signs or
okay,
that's a franchise. Very successful franchise, in fact. You know, I've got to jump on a call with a company called Lawn Doctor. All they do, they maintain lawns, and you think, oh, well, where's the money in mowing lawns? Oh no,
that's a lot of money.
Oh no, that is a very old and very, very profitable
pool maintenance too is another one that a lot of people that's also I think franchisable. I'm not sure the players, but
yeah, there's absolutely. You know, and actually that's ripe for expansion because there are a lot of, you know, one truck pool maintenance guys. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, when you're looking at developing a franchise, where's an industry ripe for, I'm trying to think of the word, but improvement.
Yeah, improvement.
You know, where, you know, a guy with a clean shirt. Yeah. And a truck with both taillights that work sometimes. that's easy, you know. And you put together the software. Do you get integrated in real world? You put a call center in so you don't have a guy. Yeah. Talking on the cell phone, trying to write down in a calendar while driving down the road. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, pool. There's some awesome new pool service companies. It's just funny. They're kind of top of mind, but that's a great example.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing about the franchise model, you know, as opposed to like, okay, quote unquote, traditional entrepreneurial, I come up with a great idea. Wow. Yay. I think the interesting thing about the franchise model is that they've proven the business model and like the e-myth, right? They have, this is the playbook. This is the blueprint. This is the documentation, whatever it is. Now, of course, since you're not inventing that from scratch, you obviously have to pay some sort of fees or whatever. But do you have any numbers on like success rates? Like what I find interesting is that, you know, let's say you wanted to get into the entrepreneur game, you know, could be whatever. And you know what? I really don't want to go and like invent something. I'd rather start off with like a franchise. I would assume they generally are going to be a little more successful than start from scratch, but I'm not sure. How does that all work?
You know, I, so take this with a small grain of salt. I don't have numbers. I don't know if they exist. I've never found any numbers that I feel like I could commit to, right? But that said, everything I have read, even the Wall Street Journal ran an article about how franchises versus independent restaurants did during the pandemic, for example. And the restaurants did extraordinarily better. And again, you can do your own research. I mean, it's pretty easy to Google in, you know, I'm sure Inc. probably has something. I mean, you know, there are numbers available out there, but typically they do better. And there's kind of a catchphrase, but it also makes sense, right? You're in business for yourself, but not by yourself. And, you know, think when the pandemic hit, if I was an independent business, you know, trying to get money in the door and food out the back or, you know, whatever it is, you don't have a lot of time. And any business owner knows this. You don't have a lot of time to scratch your chin and say, huh, well, I heard on the news today there's a pandemic, how that's going to affect me. But what as a franchisee, typically the franchisor is tied to your success they have that global both responsibility, that obligation, but also that imperative to fix it or to anticipate big changes and leveraging, you know, in the case of food, I mean, I'm thinking of one brand actually based here in the East Bay in Danville, but they very quickly rolled out. It was, you know, like a smoothie, a healthy restaurant option. They ran out, they developed an app, for example, so people could go online, order and pay online, right? In the first month of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And to the point where restaurant owners were having their biggest months ever after a couple months. And they're like, I don't even know why I opened a dining room. I put a table out front, people pay up front or pay online. We leave the drinks out front. They pick them up, easy peasy. Yeah. And then you contrast that against a independent restaurant there. I mean, I know in my own city in Pleasanton, very, very nice place, but their independent restaurants gone out of business. I believe for reasons that were entirely preventable.
So. Yeah, no, I mean, there was a couple in my neighborhood, my old neighborhood, where they thought the pandemic was only going to last a couple of weeks, shut down, and then never opened again. And it was a chain. And I think the interesting thing about that is, and I think you're right, the support network of, you know, we've got kind of got your back, or look, this is what the global world is saying or looking like. This is how we think you should adapt to it. Because, you know, if you've done anything with small business owners, I used to be a counselor at SCORE. I mean, I know I'm not that old, but I was a point where I'm like, oh, you know, I'll just do this. I had some time. And the whole thought process of process efficiency, the whole e-myth thing, which is just spot on, right?
Right.
Because they're working in it, not on it, right? And any little disruption, any little, like, the thing just flies off the rails because they're not thinking, how do I put up these guardrails to make sure I'm okay? They're literally, you know, people say they live paycheck to paycheck. Some of these businesses, it's literally like day to day, you know, and the accounting is a box, shoebox full of receipts, maybe, you know? So that's why it's interesting to have that infrastructure.
Well, you know, something I meant to mention before, when you're looking at franchise, let's say you're an investor looking at franchises, and if your background and SCORE probably speaks to this, but you're able, or let me put it another way, I won't represent a company that doesn't facilitate conversations between prospective franchisees and current franchisees. So you can actually get a lot of information from current franchisees, you know, about profitability, you know, hard numbers, you know, just depending on your approach. And this development team at the franchisee, by the way, are very, you know, they're salespeople, right? So I'm not gonna cast aspersions on salespeople. But they're very motivated, very intelligent people to move franchises, right? They're telling me this. Has that been in your experience? Or how have you dealt with, A, B, and C, employee retention, you know, or, you know, supply disruptions or whatever. And you get the real skinny from them, right? In my case, franchisees I spoke to 14 years ago, when I was invested in my first franchise, I'm still close to. They were my first stop when I had business problems. So I guess that comes under benefits of franchise ownership and you know, opportunity if you had a business that you wanted to franchise, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's also, you know, we always talk about scale for any kind of startup, right?
Right.
And, you know, usually it's pretty classical, you know, startup is get an idea, does it really work? So you get this thing called product market fit, or you get a minimum viable product. Then you go to the market. Oh, get product market fit. Who knows, right? Once you've kind of understood that, then there's the whole, this go to market strategy, right? Where it's like, okay, I'm ramping into this. Then you start to get the, how do I go from the place I am? Because each level is, it takes a different skill. It takes a different mindset. You know, going from zero to hero, right, to me is $0 in revenue to like $1 million in revenue. That's a catastrophically hard thing. Right?
Yeah.
You cannot put, there is not enough emphasis on how hard zero to hero is. But million to 10 million, 10 million to 100 million, 10 million to 20 million, that's when it's not about the innovation. It's about what franchises, I think, do really well, which is the process, the business process. This is the efficiencies of scale. This is how we scale. And there's a massive disconnect, right? So if you find yourself as an entrepreneur or just as a general human, not as much attention to detail in terms of doing that kind of thing, the process, or figuring out what works, it seems to me that like the franchise model is like, here's the playbook. Yeah. And, you know, within reason, of course, you may have innovations on your own, but it seems like a good option for folks that, and I think you have to have some capital, right? Like there's no, you just, it's not like a zero down kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, typically you're gaining access to IP. So you're going to pay a franchise fee. There are usually upfront costs. And then if you're purchasing a brick and mortar, build out costs for a commercial facility, and that can range, you know, if you have a second generation medical office and you have a medical franchise, maybe that's zero. But if you're building out a McDonald's, it could be multi-million dollars. Just kind of depends in addition to everything else.
Yeah.
But let me reflect on a book I read, I don't know, a while ago, but I believe it was by Michael Dell. And he talked about Dell Computer Strategy, and that was fast follow. And what that means, for those of you who don't know, Dell is not necessarily cutting edge technologically, but what they can do is follow the technology, or at least at the point where that book was written, right? And that's essentially what a franchise is, right? Again, you don't go to I want to stop using McDonald's because I don't represent them.
And here's one you represent. I think.
Yeah. Let's see.
Let's get some promo in here.
Yeah. Foster's Freeze. You don't go to Foster's Freeze because they have the best hamburgers in the world. Although I think they're pretty good, but you go there because you know, or Dairy Queen. That's another good example. You know, you're going to get the same thing. You're going to get a product that's going to, your child's going to love, or you know what you're getting for. There's a consistent level of customer service and food quality and X, Y, and Z. So, that's what it's about. It's not, and the other thing is, I'll use myself as an example. I'm not Thomas Edison or Elon Musk or anything. I'm not going to come up with the next great, you know, newest mousetrap, right? But I'm confident I can work harder than most people. And I am confident that I know how to treat people in a way they'll come back for more. And I'm confident I can read a manual, an operations manual, and execute a plan, you know, those type of things. And I'm open to coaching. I mean, I can't overemphasize that. Those are the people, we are the people that make great franchise owners. I'm kind of going on here, but Elon Musk, I love following Elon Musk. I have a Tesla solar roof. I have just been amazed by SpaceX and everything they've done, and the Tesla automobile, and the, you know, fill in the blanks, right? He would suck as a franchise owner.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, because he would break, you know, hey, we got this software we want you to use. Oh, well, it doesn't automatically tweet my location or what, and he'd be breaking it, right? And I say that in all respect and love.
No, I'm glad you brought that up because, it's a different mindset.
Yeah, totally. And that's okay. We need those people in America. Thank goodness we've got an African-American that decided to move to America and do what he's done. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
But terrible franchise owner. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it's interesting. I like this distinction because a lot of times, so, you know, I'm always like talk about the blue collar work ethic. And I think more tech entrepreneurs should really embrace this idea because I have a tremendous respect for blue collar workers that the skill level, the dedication, the smarts, like the ingenuity. I'm like a big fan because I really think it's not talked about enough that being an entrepreneur, the attitude is it's mostly the blue collar work ethic. It's really not the creativity. Now, for a SaaS startup, for these ones where you're starting from scratch, yes, there's a creativity in the beginning. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you got to know what you're doing. But the generally, and I'm going to say 80% of it, to be honest, is blue-collar work ethic. How are you going to build this thing so that it's reproducible, it's time certain in terms of revenue models and everything? And well, while that mix may be leaning a little less than 80% in the beginning, chances are like what you're building, someone's built before, and you're just doing it in a different way, right? And so that's the reason why I think the blue collar work ethic kind of ethos, for lack of a better word, is I was just not championed enough. And the innovation in a franchisee or franchisor, like coming up with how you can basically train anyone to do your business, kind of like the military, right? You look at a military manual and you're like, this is Sesame Street simple to do. I mean, you could take an 18-year-old kid and they're like, we're going to teach you how to, you know, maintain an F-18, right? Or missile. Yeah. Like, you would be shocked. You read some of these manuals, you're like, you are be shocked at how simple it is. Like, turn this bolt this way. And not to diminish, like, that does take some intelligence. But I honestly think the military has done a pretty good job of, like, they can take anyone within reason, right? And teach them a job and make them productive. And whatever you think about the military and all that, that's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And I think that's what franchisors do. There is a certain amount of innovation and art in that I think a lot of entrepreneurs can learn from, because it is super important that when you hit a certain point, your mindset shifts from Elon Musk to, you know, being the blue collar
operator. Doing repeatable business. But let me, I'm going to go back to McDonald's because this speaks directly to this. So one of my favorite high school teachers, he retired from the school district, I want to say in the late 80s, but he took a job teaching English in Poland, in Krakow, Poland. I believe it's Krakow, but not a lot of Western influences. But he was. I met him in London. I was still in the Navy, and he was still there. He flew over. We spent a weekend together. Just great guy, great friend. But he's like, you know, I am living on, what was it, the salary of a teacher in Poland, and I'm just putting all my other money aside because I want to live the life they are. And he says, my one treat to myself every week is Sunday. I go and have dinner at McDonald's. There's a McDonald's that opened. And he says, Steve, you wouldn't believe the state of customer service in that city, with the exception of the McDonald's. He says, there are people with smiles on their faces, pushing brooms, and it's a mindset change. And he says, no matter what you think about McDonald's, they are changing the economy in Poland. And look at Poland now, 30 years later, and they are Yeah, I've been told that Poland, we'll probably get letters from Polish people, but Poland would be willing to become the 51st state of the U.S. And I don't know if that's a measure of success or
well,
not.
You make a good point, because I was actually, funnily enough, watching a show about the Polish army and the readiness of the Polish army to stave off an invasion from Russia, of course, because we're talking about Ukraine's been invaded, and that's around this time, right? So Poland's part of NATO, and they, to your point, when they got out of the Eastern Bloc and they decided, okay, how are we going to be independent? They made a tough decision, but a very shrewd decision. They said, we want to be more democratic, and we're going to start by eliminating corruption in the army. Now, you may think, what does that have to do with anything? Well, if you are a student of history, like you and I are, and you've seen anything related to the war in Ukraine and the capability of the Russian army, you will know for a fact how corrupt it is. And the reason why this corruption is the reason why it's bogged down in the Ukraine. Like, no ands, ifs, or buts about it. And it's because the leadership, the officers, right, the field officers' attitude was corrupt. I mean, they steal stuff from them, like, full stop.
Right.
That degrades readiness or whatever. So Poland said, we're not going to do that. We are going to overhaul this. We're actually going to root out corruption. Why is that important? For exactly the reasons you talked about when it comes to quality and consistency. When people are aligned that the benefits to what they're doing come back to them as opposed to gaffe. And I'm not saying everything's perfect. Me in the US, we're not perfect, but you can clearly point out corruption everywhere. But there's a certain level of, like, we're not going to tolerate, and we have checks and balances. And that's what Poland was trying to do. And what's interesting is that, you know, that was like, 94 when they got out of the Warsaw Pact.
There was it was more like 89.
89, right?
Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah, around the wall. So right. So, and they were making this progress. And even in their military, they decided, you know what? We don't need a military anymore. We're going to reduce it down, right? And we're going to make sure it has certain things. Well, 2014, they said, oh my gosh, we probably have to do something about this, right? Because I don't know if they saw the writing on the wall or whatever. But then they started building it back up. And the reason I bring this all up is because what you talked about Poland is one of the most democratic growing economies from the Eastern Bloc in Europe, actually a model for how that transition happened. And that attitude about the people in that McDonald's and how it was spreading, they embraced, to your point, being coachable. This is how we do things, right? That's incredible. And I think that is the testament to the idea of innovation through process. Like, I think that's what franchisors do.
Yeah. If I could put a neat bow, I call it the rule of law, being dedicated to the rule of law as opposed to the rule of personality.
Yeah. And you see that. I mean, you look at any corruption index, right? And you look at the players in any political system, even here, right? It doesn't matter what side of the spectrum you're on. And I call it spectrum because people are sometimes on the spectrum and get all whacked. It's like, no. Follow the money. Look at where these things are going, right? Like, it's not all what it seems, but we still have, like, there's a free press. There's rules. And whether you like more government or less government or whatever, like, the rule, they set the rule. If we all play by the same rules, then that's great. We're playing. To your point, I'm a hard worker. There's no one that can outwork me. They can if the deck is stacked against you. And I think that's the reason why franchisees and franchisors are just such a powerful tool or powerful model. A tool is not a right word, powerful model, because, hey, man, you want to work hard? We know this works. We've done it 25 times before. Have at it. And oh, by the way, we're here to make sure you're successful. That's a pretty powerful thing. And I don't think, again, not talked about enough. It should be. And I think also where it comes into play is, we talked a little bit about this before, is that you're actually helping veterans become franchise owners, which I think is a very, one very needed. I mean, our veterans need all of our support for their service. And you know, your service is much appreciated. But also, I mean, coming out of the military, I mean, I've never been in, but I have buddies that, I mean, like, my guess is they're pretty good at it, considering it's like, here's the book, go for it. You know, I mean, is that true? Or am I just like fantasizing about it? I don't know.
No. What is it? One out of seven franchise owners, I believe, has a military veteran background. And you're exactly right. I mean, there are two things. I mean, as veterans, you learn how to read and execute a plan, but also how to keep the mission in sight, right? I think as Colin Powell had said, maybe it was Jim Matthews, no op plan survives first contact, right? So once the bullets start flying, difference between a successful and unsuccessful soldier is someone who can transition from you know reacting to the bullets to focusing on the mission, how I'm going to accomplish it now.
Yeah, I think General Mateus said the same thing. What was it? The most important.
Petraeus?
No, I think it was Mateus. He said the most important 6 inches on the battlefield is between your head or between your ears. I mean, one of those guys did, but.
Yeah. What? Yeah. but it's true. It's true. It's the same thing with how do you keep moving forward, both literally and figuratively, with the franchise. And I know for me, sometimes it was a struggle, right? And I mean, I would love to talk about how I made the decision to sell, but I think that's a story for a different day. But, I think as owners, as presidents, as executives, that as managers, we owe our employees a couple things. And one is the tools to be successful, whatever those tools are. And then number two is a vision. And that's about it. What is the vision? The vision is to serve a hamburger to everyone within a 5-mile radius, or to replace 10% of the signs in our community with this new lighted sign we're selling, or whatever it is. What's the vision? That's our goal as owners, as leaders. And then providing the tools. Sometimes that tool is, you know, some additional training or guidance in particular areas. Sometimes it's a new screwdriver, right? Sometimes it's a truck that doesn't break down. I had one of those trucks and I had to get a repair. But that's what it comes to. And the franchise gives you that opportunity to define what are the tools, what is the vision, how we're going to help you get there. And move forward.
Wow. I mean, this has been a great conversation. I think it's one of those things we could go on forever, but I really appreciate your time. And it's just, you can always learn a ton from different things, you know? And I think that's the thing that I always take away from these interviews, as well as like different perspectives. And so I appreciate your perspective on franchising, the power of it, the importance of it. And good luck. Stay safe, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thanks, Steve, for being on the show and a excellent discussion about how franchises. Never knew that most of them aren't restaurants. So here, as promised, are your actionable insights that I learned from my interview with Steve. A franchise requires upfront capital, but buying a franchise can be a good way to start a business if you don't have specific product or services ready to offer, providing you're willing to work hard, follow a process, and accept help. So yeah, one of the major benefits, obviously, is that they sort of have a playbook for how to do it. And that is, can be beneficial if you're just starting out or, you know, you don't know really what to do. As he did mention, they do have upfront costs, so you got to worry about that. But if you are thinking about being an entrepreneur and you really don't have a product yet, I mean, you can ask yourself the questions like, is a franchise right for me? Are there anything I'm in particularly interested in? Do I have experience? Maybe it's a plumbing franchise or some other thing that you may be able to use your skills. And it's just as entrepreneurial because you actually have to go in and, you know, get market share in a market that may or may not be, you know, may not have that service in there. So it's definitely something to think about, and it's an interesting way to go. Franchises are generally more successful than other types of startups. Steve notes that franchises were well suited to pivot quickly when the pandemic hit. Corporations can provide tools and brain power to help make this happen. So the thing about a franchise, obviously, is that there is a vested interest in making it successful. So even though you have to pay up front, get the licensing or whatever, the corporate folk, you know, they see the entire landscape. There's also some economies of scale, right? So if you do want to pursue it, there is going to be some support. Now, my guess is there's some that are better than others, like anything. But I think generally, you know, the model is if you're successful, then other, you know, other people are successful. And there's a group of people in that same business that can help you, right? I think that's also the power of it. So, you know, think it's good to think about, right? Not, you know, not maybe as creative, but you can make it as creative as you want, right? Franchising can help businesses grow once you've reached a certain point. So consider this as part of your growth strategy. So let's say you own your own business and you want to make it into a franchise. This is sort of the e-myth kind of methodology. Well, while, you know, don't work in your business, work on your business, build processes into control. So if you are thinking about it, you know, ask yourself the question, hey, how much of my processes are documented? Is this easily scalable? Can I teach someone else to do this? I mean, that's a very important and very powerful thing, because as you kind of get more and more into your business, you may find that, yeah, you can franchise it. So definitely something to think about for growth. Well, there you have it, the actionable insights that I learned from my interview with Steve. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur and, frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.